We are talking today with Robert McChesney. He is the author of The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century. Robert, thanks for spending time with us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
What is the problem of the media?
Well, I think when you hear the term problem of the media, most people think in terms of, well, that means lousy media content, bad journalism, biased journalism, bad content, hyper-commercialism. And that's part of what the problem of the media is. But when I talk about it in this book, I mean it more than just bad media content that causes a problem. I mean more that there's a mathematical problem. Every society has what I call the problem of the media, which is it has to determine how to structure its media system. And it's an unavoidable problem in any society, how to allocate resources, set up institutions, lines of authority. And our society, like every other, has made a series of decisions to solve the problem of the media. And the difficulty with that, I don't want to use the word problem twice, is the way we have solved the problem of the media, the social problem, how you construct a media system, has been very corrupt. It's been done behind closed doors by very powerful special interests. And as a result, we have a media system that is very much set up to suit the needs of those special interests, but does a very poor job of meeting the needs of the people of the country.
And from the subtitle of your book, is this something that has just happened recently in this current century?
Well, the problem in the mathematical sense or the social sense, the problem has always existed, but it's become a crisis in recent times. And for example, you know, a lot of people think, well, freedom of the press in the United States, the First Amendment of the Constitution says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press or press freedom. And a lot of people think, well, that must mean that the government does nothing and lets the private sector do whatever it wants to make money, and that's what freedom of the press means. But that's really not the case at all. That's one part of our constitutional mandate with regard to press freedom. That's one aspect of it, to prevent any sort of censorship of content of the press. Not always fulfilled, but ideally always fulfilled. But we also have a much richer tradition where we have unavoidable policies which shape strongly the type of press system and therefore the type of content we get. And we've had them from the very beginning of the Republic. For example, we had enormous printing subsidies by the government to spawn a diverse range of newspapers that wouldn't have existed without these subsidies if left simply to rich people. More importantly, we had extensive postal subsidies where the federal government charged newspapers very little money to be mailed because they wanted to encourage a broad range of newspapers. These were very successful policies, and I think historians regard them as foundational for how we had such an elaborate and booming press culture in this country and literacy in the northern states in the years prior to the Civil War. It was the result of policy, aggressive government policies made to promote democracy in that period. We still have enormous subsidies for our papers today and our media in general today. The gift of radio and TV licenses to companies, monopoly rights to radio and TV channels. The companies don't pay the government a penny for the scarce public property. It's worth an immense amount of money, in the billions of dollars annually, if not more. Likewise, in a city like Seattle, you only have one cable company to choose from, Comcast. It has a government-granted and enforced monopoly license to be the one cable company. So when a company gets one of these cable monopolies or when it gets monopoly rights to radio or TV channels, it's not just sort of set up to be able to compete. It's set up almost to win. Once you get that, you've already won the competition. You can't help but make money. And then third, another crucial form of subsidy that we currently have is copyright. Now, copyright was set up in the Constitution with the theory that would balance the need to make sure producers of content would get enough support so they would keep producing books or whatever content they do. And then after they get enough support, the monopoly protection the government gives in the form of copyright protection would be gone and it would enter the public domain and anyone could share in the common cultural heritage. Well, copyright today has been taken over by big corporations and extended way beyond what the founders had in mind. It's almost permanent copyright, and it's privatized much of our culture. Nothing new has entered our public domain now in something like 70 years because they keep extending copyright. But it's worth also billions and billions of dollars in value annually to these big media companies. So these are enormous public subsidies we still have that build our media system. It's not a free market system. The problem we face, though, is that these policies we have are work basically to suit the big powerful interests that benefit from the corporations. They don't suit us. And it produces a media system that basically works to make a lot of money for them, but I think, again, does a really disastrous job of meeting the needs of the American people, being a free press and a free society. And really, when you get right down to it, in a democratic society, it's crucial that we solve the problem of the media by creating a press that promotes democratic values. If we don't, we haven't solved it. We flunked the test, and right now we're flunking the test.
So how do you see us solving this if it's gotten so bad?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. The way that we make media policies in the United States, the way they're made in this country, we're told that this is a natural system, that you know, God handed a tablet to Thomas Jefferson, who handed it to Rupert Murdoch, thou shalt own all the media. That's not the case. This is the result, again, of policies made recently. It has nothing to do with the Founding Fathers and their values and what they envisioned as freedom of the press. It really has nothing to do with a free market. This is not some libertarian market system we have. In fact, even if you wanted a libertarian free market media system, and I wouldn't propose such a thing, but even if that was someone's goal, it would require extensive government policies just to create the foundations to have that type of system. It would not happen naturally just by like doing nothing. You can't, doing nothing isn't an option. So what would you do? Well, I think if you understand that the problem is corrupt policymaking, these airwaves, these cable licenses, these copyright terms, all the internet policymaking decisions, all these policies are made behind closed doors by very powerful special interests, and that's why the policies are so flawed, the solution becomes clear. We have to democratize the policymaking process. We have to get informed public consent involved in how these policies are being made. And if we do, I think we'll get policies that will produce a much better system, which will then produce much better content.
Saw recently here in Seattle a year or so back hearings on the FCC proposed changes of expanding even further how many stations radio corporations could own, and we saw a lot of public turnout for that. Do you see that as an encouraging sign?
More than an encouraging sign. I think that was just the tip of the iceberg. You know, 2 years ago, in 2002, when I would raise these issues, and I've been writing books about media and media policy now for 10 or 15 years. And it always, people would be very depressed because there's nothing we can do about it. My books, I'd write about how powerful these companies are, how much influence they have, how corrupt the policymaking process is, how there's no press coverage, so how can you possibly get people interested? And people would say, gosh, Bob, I mean, you've convinced me we've got a problem, but you've also convinced me it's almost hopeless to change it. They're so powerful. And I secretly sort of have to agree because it did look pretty dark, even though I understood how important these issues were and how much people did genuinely care about having a free press, that it really struck something very fundamental in the American soul. But in the last 2 years, I think we've seen an astonishing and entirely unanticipated burst of interest in media issues that I don't think anyone, I certainly didn't think would take place 2 years ago. And it was triggered by the Federal Communications Commission's decision to review its few remaining media ownership rules. And what these were was a series of rules that prevented media companies from getting a lot bigger. And the theory was that when the government gives monopoly licenses to radio and TV companies, they can own radio and TV stations and have monopoly rights to these channels, the government should put a limit on how many of these monopoly licenses a single company can have, because it's not a good thing if all the radio or TV stations are owned by one company or two companies. Or if they take the monopoly profits they make from these radio and TV stations and buy up the newspapers and magazines and all the other media in the country, that a healthy democracy depends on a diverse number of owners, and the more the barrier. I mean, that the bias in a democratic society has always got to be towards more voices, not fewer. And if you're going to have an argument on behalf of having fewer and fewer voices available in the media, you've got to meet a high threshold of evidence. It's not like everything else being equal doesn't matter. If it doesn't really matter, they'd always go for more rather than few voices. I mean, this is politics 101. This is a basic democratic common sense. So the Federal Communications Commission is going to review longstanding rules that have prevented media concentration. And there's tremendous pressure on the FCC, which is very much a captive regulatory agency traditionally, meaning that industry usually gets its way with it since most Americans don't know what's going on. There's tremendous pressure on the FCC to relax these rules because the big media companies desperately want to be able to get bigger and bigger. Then they have less competition. Their profits go up. They can do more advertising. They can pay less for their expenses because they have less competition. It's a dream scenario for the big media companies. And, you know, when this was announced that the SEC was going to review these rules in the fall of 2002, as I said, I was somewhat depressed. I remember I wrote an article in The Nation or in These Times with my friend John Nichols, and we basically said it's over. You know, the FCC, it's three of the five members are Republicans who are total pawns of the industry, and they are. The Congress, House and Senate are both Republican, and the leadership is totally in bed with the industry, and it is. And the Bush administration, more than any administration in history, is not just in the pocket of industry, it's in the underpants of industry. I mean, Rupert Murdoch, Clear Channel, Sinclair, they will die on their sword to advance the interests of the biggest media companies to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So it looked hopeless. It looked like, you know, we could just like tilting at windmills to try to possibly stop the FCC from relaxing the media ownership rules and letting the biggest media companies buy up all the media in a community or much of it. In fact, if the rule changes were to go through that they were considering and have been and are considering, it would let a single company go into a city, own the daily newspaper, three television stations, eight radio stations, the cable system, in one city, basically one-stop shopping, company town. And you'd have one newsroom serving the entire community, two if you were lucky in a bigger city maybe, but very little competition. And what we know historically is when you only have one newsroom covering a community, no competition, no pressing, you're not getting very good news. There's a tremendous lethargy that's built, and even well-intended, and it's probably not going to be very well-intended if Clear Channel or Sinclair is the company that owns all the media in your town. So we thought it was going to be tough. And then all of a sudden, during the course of 2003, there was an absolute explosion in interest in this issue across the political spectrum in the United States when people heard about it. And what we had, and what really triggered this, among other things, was that two of the five members of the FCC, the Democrats, were unusually principled public servants. And I don't mean to make this a Democrat-Republican thing, because most of the Democrats that preceded them were no better than the Republicans. I mean, it's not the tradition on the SEC is for these to be patronage appointments. But the two Democrats, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, really genuinely believed that issues about media ownership were so important the public ought to be allowed to know about them and weigh in on them. They shouldn't be done behind closed doors with all the lobbyists. So they went around the country last year and held 12 public hearings. And that was, to get back to your question, what you were talking about, is one of the 12 was here in Seattle. And what they found that everyone, just like in Seattle, they had attracted crowds between 400, 500, 600, as many as 1,000 or 1,200 people, who were just enthusiastic and passionate about their interest in this issue. I mean, they were concerned about hyper-commercialism. They were concerned about lousy journalism. They were concerned about the fact that musical playlist on so many radio stations, commercial radio stations in this country, have all the variety of a McDonald's menu. And when the commissioners heard this, it galvanized them. They said, wow, this is really something. I'm not hearing anyone out here across the political spectrum who likes the idea of having fewer media owners. This is really quite amazing. And then the word started to trickle out, and the Move On, the internet group, got involved in it. And the group I helped start, Free Press, got involved in it. And we got involved with Free Press, with Move On, and Common Cause, Consumers Union. And at the local level, there were groups all around the country, or groups of activists that got involved, like here, Reclaim the Media, wonderful local group that's very active on this issue and on cable access issues and LPFM issues. And this movement absolutely exploded. You know, we had, by the end of May, the FCC, when it was just about to go in for its June 2nd vote, got so many emails that it blew out the computer system at the FCC, literally blew it out. I mean, they had to close down the computers at the Federal Communications Commission because there was so much traffic coming in, it blew up the computer system. That's just the beginning of it. We lost the vote 3-2 at the FCC because the three Republicans who were on the FCC actually said, even before we do any study of the issue, we know how we're going to vote. We want to get rid of these rules. So they had pure contempt for the idea that there would be any sort of review whatsoever. It was all about just giving the goods to Sinclair and Gannett and Clear Channel and Rupert Murdoch. But then Congress had a chance to weigh in because the FCC works for Congress. They're appointed by them. They're supposed to enforce Congress's will. We were organized in Congress, all of us, Free Press, Common Cause, Move On, a lot of the local groups like Reclaim the Media, and we were able to generate literally millions of people to telephone, email, and write Congress over the summer and the fall, to the extent that in the fall the Senate overturned the entire FCC package, 55-40 vote, unprecedented vote, the entirety voted down, 55-40 in the Republican-controlled Senate. In the House, they won't let it come to a vote because the last thing Hastert, the Speaker, wants is that it's come to a vote because he knows they'll lose, that we'll overturn it, because there's just no support for this in this country except for those who have money on the line or politicians who are bought off by those with money on the line. This is a classic case of money versus the interest of virtually the entirety of the population. So, I mean, it's a long answer to a question. What we're in is an extraordinary moment. Now, those media ownership rules were also at a decisive moment because they haven't been implemented. They haven't been relaxed yet. Because the Philadelphia Appeals Court, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, put a stay on them, and it's reviewing a lawsuit brought by the Media Access Project and the Prometheus Media Group in Philly to challenge the FCC how it went about implementing the rules changes. We're going to get the decision any day now, maybe even before we go on air, but certainly by the end of June. And we think there's a very good chance we're going to win this case. And then it'll be sent back to the FCC again to do it right this time and actually pay attention to what people have to say, like you're supposed to in the statute. You're supposed to be concerned with issues of the public interest. And if that does go back, we're going to see a round of organizing around media ownership in the next year that's going to make last year look like a snooze fest. It's going to be a revolution in this country around media.
What if it loses in the Third Circuit? Can people still put pressure on the House?
Yeah, we can still put pressure on the House. The way the rule is written, it still comes up for review. All these same rules technically, but legally, have to be reviewed again by the FCC next year. Every 2 years, they're required to be reviewed. So we'll just do the same thing next year, but we'll start with the rules having been relaxed. But I'm pretty confident that's not going to happen. And I will say this. If there's a different administration in the White House, whoever party controls the White House is a majority on the FCC. So if the Democrats, for example, were to be in power come November, you'd have a three-person Democratic majority on the FCC in January. All these rules would get thrown out immediately. That will end this matter.
So do you think a lot of the reasons that contributed to the wave of people that were concerned about this and came out and spoke was because media has consolidated as much as it as the system really will allow it to before the citizens it's serving kind of take to the streets? Or
well, I think there are a number of reasons why there was this explosion and is this explosion, and why today when I travel around, this is an issue that captivates people so much. And what happened in 2003 and now is really a volcanic response to tensions and concerns people have had for a long time, but they didn't know they could do anything about them. I think there were lots of people, for example, who were very upset at the way the Seattle WTO protests were covered in the commercial press. Very upset. They didn't know you could protest about it. You yell and scream, I don't like the coverage. They didn't understand that the media system that did this was not a natural system, but was the result of policies that gave a handful of companies all this power. And then finally in 2003, what happened is that people who had deep-seated problems with the media understood it actually is a political question, policy decisions that gave these companies this power, and that we had a right, indeed a duty, to change these policies to make a better system. And once you understood it was a political issue to change these policies, well, I think a lot of people who had real concerns that just said, well, let's do it, man. Why on earth are we letting these people have so much power over our culture? So in 2003, there were two or three things that really triggered it. One was the coverage of the war in Iraq. I mean, the coverage of the war leading to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. You know, we had millions of Americans who protested that this was not a good idea during the months leading up to the invasion. And during this period, President Bush was making the argument that we had to invade because there was an imminent threat from weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that Iraq was the center of an al-Qaeda terrorist network, so we had to take them out in the battle against terrorism. Our news media largely regurgitated that opinion and didn't give much critical substance, didn't demand very much hard evidence to back those claims up, more or less just repeated them over and over. Most Americans probably believe them. Surveys tend to suggest they did. But a lot of Americans could read, using the internet, could look at the international media and see that virtually the entirety of the press everywhere else in the world thought there was no evidence for these claims. These were ridiculous. And it was sort of this enormous cognitive dissonance between everyone else in the world and our sort of, as they say, attack poodle media, which is really regurgitating what the president and the White House was saying. And so people were very upset that why is our news media going along with this? Why aren't they demanding hard evidence about this weapons of mass destruction? When in fact, Scott Ritter, the people in charge of looking for these weapons, say they aren't there. I mean, the evidence was non-existent. And so we finally go to war, and our news media has done a horrendous job in the United States. And it comes out, this is interesting, it comes out exactly at the time we go to war, people become aware of the fact that the same companies that have been doing the lousy press coverage of the war, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, MSNBC, CBS, Sinclair Broadcasting, Clear Channel Broadcasting, are the lobbyists leading the fight so they can get more media by relaxing the media ownership rules. Well, this made all the people who were anti-war organizers or protesters instantly become media activists. They're saying, this is absurd. We can't let these guys triple their holdings in media. It's bad enough what we have now. This is outrageous. In fact, we shouldn't let them have this much media. They don't have any right to dominate our culture. And so suddenly groups like MoveOn.org got millions of Americans, turned them into media activists. And what MoveOn found, what they told us as we worked with them at Free Press, was that they got a stronger response to their media reach out efforts to get people to sign on to protest media concentration to anything about the war, that this just galvanized people in a way they had never seen. And it wasn't just the war, though. There was a lot of conservative support, and there is a lot of conservative support, self-identified conservative support for this. And it takes a lot of forms. William Safire, the columnist for the New York Times, the leading American conservative, you know, I probably disagreed with everything he's ever written on every subject except this. I mean, he wrote 8 or 9 columns in the last year and a half, basically arguing that opposing media concentration and having democratic media policymaking is not only something conservatives should support, it should be the central conservative issue, because genuine conservatives should be opposed not only to government concentration of power, but private concentrations of powers, especially in the media and the press. This is the conservative issue. And a lot of conservatives who aren't part of the big money system, who aren't getting paid off by Clear Channel or politicians who are on the take, like most of these guys in Washington, they get it. They like the idea of having local owners to their TV and radio stations in North Carolina or Washington State or Idaho or wherever they live. They like the idea of having media that's accountable to their communities, people who are there, who live there, who cover the community, that do journalism. They don't like the idea of having their kids' brains commercially dunked into a pickle jar on these TV channels with this commercial carpet bombing we do of children in this culture. And I think a lot of conservatives actually understand that the vulgarity that they find offensive in so much of our media is driven by hyper-commercialism, that the channels that are most vulgar, most grotesque, most offensive tend to be the most commercial channels that are simply using vulgarity as the cheapest way to grab an audience. I doubt anyone's ever complained about vulgarity on KEXP, for example, really, genuine vulgarity, because it wouldn't make sense here. You're not out to get an audience by any means necessary. You're here to do a public service. You're here to really serve your community. Vulgarity, though, makes perfect sense on a Rupert Murdoch station, where you're doing anything you possibly can to turn people upside down and shake the money out of their pants, and you want to get their attention as quickly and cheaply as possible. So if you could show someone cutting a fart, hell, do it. You'll get people to watch your ad.
Do you give much weight to people lobbying their own community outlets? For instance, we have two dailies here, people sending in letters saying, you know, we really feel the content of what you printed on any given day needs some correction.
Oh, I'm a big believer in what I call the multi-front approach. I don't think there's one place you do all your work. I think you fight on a whole number of fronts. I mean, you fight to change these policies in Washington, but a lot of the policies we try to change are local. For example, right here in Seattle, you've got a really important fight coming up for this community because Comcast has got to renegotiate its contract for its cable monopoly in Seattle. Now, the citizens of this country, thanks to a very progressive law that activists got passed quite some time ago, have the right to go in on these cable deals and force these monopoly cable companies to give a number of public access channels on the system and give the funding for the equipment. But the Comcast won't give it to you voluntarily. You've got to organize to do it. So this is the sort of fight that people can go out and organize at the local level. And there's also issues at the national level like ownership or public broadcasting and even some global issues that we organize around. But there's a whole range of issues that people can organize around. There's also the stuff of doing independent media, supporting stations like this, supporting the IMC, supporting independent nonprofit media, supporting small commercial media that do an alternative or independent voice that aren't sort of under the commercial thumb. That's a very important part of the process, too. And then hectoring and badgering and monitoring the existing mainstream media. I mean, in some cases, it's hard to do. Like, it'd be nice to badger local radio stations to cover the communities better, to have better journalism. But since they have no journalism anymore to speak of, who are you going to badger? Some robot disc jockey that's sent in by some corporate radio company? I mean, there's no one to hassle there in these stations anymore.
I'm gathering then that since 2002, you have regained some of your hope that we can take back our media?
More than regained it. I know that we will take it. We are going to win if we organize. What's been striking, what all the evidence has shown, let me back up and give you an example. A few days ago, I had a chance to meet with Patrick Cadell. Patrick Cadell was the main pollster for Jimmy Carter when he got elected in 1976, and was George McGovern's pollster in 1972. He's a legendary pollster for getting to the sort of his finger on the pulse of the American people and what moves them. He's one of the people who's credited with Carter's victory, and actually McGovern's ability to win the primary in 72. And we were talking to him a few days ago, and he said that he never saw anything in his career like the response to the media ownership fight in 2003. The depth, the intensity of this anger and rising up of people against media concentration. He said he just hadn't seen anything like it across the political spectrum, unprecedented in his career as a pollster, that he'd seen anything like it. I mean, the soil, it's like 10-foot deep Iowa topsoil to organize out there. It's not like there's anyone out there when I go out to talk and says, gee, I really like all this advertising my kids are getting. Gee, I really like that if one company owns all the media in my town that's 8 states away and has no journalism locally. No one likes that. It's so easy to organize. But that doesn't mean it's not a tough fight. We're going up against, you know, the extraordinarily powerful lobbies. They control the news media. They traditionally own all the politicians. It's not going to necessarily be easy, but what we do know is if we do the organizing and we make this an issue, get people aware of what they're entitled to, their rights and responsibilities in the society to build a free press, the more people know about it, the more they want to change the policies that built the system, the more likely we are to win. So our whole fight is just to make it an issue. Once it's an issue, we're going to win. I have no doubt about that. I'm perfectly comfortable with the outcome of a fair debate, and I'm live with it. The problem is the other side knows that if there's a fair debate, they're cooked.
Tell me about the Free Press.
Free Press is a group that I started with my good friend John Nichols and Josh Silver in the fall of 2002. And the idea was to try to have a national group that would really be proactive and get people involved in media activism. We wanted to get it outside the Beltway and make it a popular issue in this country. And when we started, we envisioned it being the sort of slow ramp up that was going to take 5, 10, 15 years. And we wanted it to be like the environmental movement, where we'd make media policy an issue that all politicians, not a partisan issue, but it's just something everyone has to deal with, like the environment. And if an issue that's accepted as part of the public discourse, we have to talk about how we build a free press and how these policies are used to promote diversity and genuinely good journalism and good programming, entertainment, especially for our kids. And we thought it would take a long time. But then, of course, along came the media ownership fight. It was like the journalists who went to Beijing in 1989, and all of a sudden Tiananmen Square showed up, and it sort of changed the world suddenly. And what's happened in 2003 was that our group, which started a year ago in May of 2003, we had one staff member. Today we have 12, a year later. Almost all organizers out organizing hearings, people around the country getting them involved in this issue. We organized, for example, public involvement in a FCC hearing in San Antonio earlier this year and had 800 or 900 people there, mostly Latino, coming out to tell the FCC commissioners how the quality of the media in San Antonio, the Clear Channel hometown, and letting the commissioners know, in no uncertain terms, especially Chairman Michael Powell, that the system was absolutely unacceptable from the public interest. Now, this is the sort of exciting stuff that's going on right now. We've got 12 members. We've got our hands full. We're fighting on a range of issues. And the way this movement's evolving is there are national groups like ourselves, Free Press, which I think is, I'd like to think is one of the leaders, which is devoted to democratizing media policymaking. And then we've got a federation. There's just exciting local groups and local activists all over the country. Seattle's very lucky to have Reclaim the Media, which is Jonathan Lawson, Susan Gleason, and a bunch of other folks doing some tremendous work here on a range of issues. There's groups like this all over the country. And the other thing we're trying to do is to draw in all the groups that have a stake in media and that should be active in this, but have basically been asleep at the wheel because they didn't realize there was anything that they could do about it. Organized labor, the environmental movement, God, do they need to get involved. Campaign finance activists. You know, campaign finance is a media issue. The number one lobby that opposes campaign finance reform in the United States by far is the media industry, because this is this political advertising golden egg they get every year now from TV ads. That's why they don't want to take the money out of politics. Civil rights organizations, civil liberties organizations, journalists, media workers. I mean, the list goes on and on. Virtually every organized constituency in this society is hurt by our terrible media system and would benefit by reform. And once we get these people alert to these issues, and we're beginning to right now and get them involved, then our numbers get really big. And then we start looking like the environmental movement. We're going to have enough grassroots heat to force whoever is in office to listen to us and pay attention to us. And, you know, there's an old saying by the great organizer Saul Alinsky that the only way you can beat organized money is with organized people. And so that's the secret here. We just have to organize people. And if we do, we'll win. If we don't, we'll lose.
How do people find out more about the Free Press?
Free Press can be found at freepress.net on the web, and it's a comprehensive website. It's accessible. It lists not only our own activities, but it has a daily headline service. It lists all the articles on all the issues concerning media policy in the country. It's indexed and archived. It's very easy to use. We've also got a list of all the issues with background readings, and we've also got a comprehensive guide to all the groups working on media in the country. It's easy to get to, so you can contact them, learn about the groups in your community, whatever issues you're interested in. freepress.net.
Thanks for spending time with us today.
It's my great pleasure.
We've just been talking with Robert McChesney. He is author of the new book, The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century.